not focused? I think I'll leave that to the imagination of the attendees here. You can always count on someone to ask the question. But anyway, so unlike the tangent bundle, which itself, so what kind of natural structure does a tangent bundle have? It has a Lie bracket, but it doesn't have a natural metric. You have to choose a metric on it in order to study metric geometry. But it's very different in the case of T plus T star because you actually have a natural split signature metric I've written down there. And what that means is that the bundle naturally has an O(n, n) structure, an orthogonal structure, it's split signature. And if you look at the bundles T and T star, they're both null. If you look at, if you just took psi and eta to be zero, then the inner product of x and y would just be zero. So both of these are actually less strong. Now, according to Cartan, whenever you have a metric bundle, which is written as the sum of two null bundles, it's very simple to figure out what the spin bundle is. What you do is you just take one of the null spaces. In this case, I've taken T star, and you take the exterior algebra on it. And then there's this bundle is naturally the spin bundle for this metric bundle. So again, I've not chosen a metric. You might say, well, you know, in the case of Riemannian geometry, there's not always a spin structure. How do we know that there exists a spin structure? Actually, in the case of T plus T star, there's always a spin structure, and that's the spin bundle. And I don't know why it keeps doing that. The first time I give an electronic lecture. Okay, so the exterior derivative exists on this spin bundle, and by using the action of T plus T star on the spin bundle, we can transport the derivation actually onto T plus T star. So we start off with something which acts on the exterior algebra, and we get a bracket structure on sections of T plus T star. This bracket operation is called the Coulomb bracket, and was discovered by Courant and Weinstein when they were studying Poisson geometry. This bracket is not a Lie bracket, but it is almost a Lie bracket in that the anomaly is an exact one-one. So it's essentially a Lie bracket of homotopy. Okay, so now that we have the setting is T plus T star, and it has a natural metric, and it has a natural bracket. And so then we can ask questions like, what kind of geometry can we have on T plus T star? So the first thing we'll do is start off with the group O(2n)(2n). So take an even-dimensional real manifold, look at T plus T star. Now we can reduce the structure down to un, comma n. Okay, this corresponds to a generalized complex structure. What's a generalized complex structure? This is a notion introduced by Hitchin a few years ago. And it has a very simple definition. It's just a complex structure on the tangent plus cotangent bundle. And we want it to be integrable. So what does it mean for it to be integrable? Usually we use the Lie bracket to determine integrability of a complex structure. But in this case, we have a Courant bracket, so we use the Courant bracket. So essentially, this other condition here, J bracket J equals zero, simply means that the plus I eigenbundle of this complex structure is closed under the Courant bracket. So one amazing thing about such complex structures is that they encapsulate both complex and symplectic geometry. They're able to interpolate algebraically between those two structures. So for example here, if we have a complex structure little j, which is just acting on T, and then its dual acts on T star, if we form this matrix, this will be a complex structure on T plus T star. And because I've put this minus sign here, this endomorphism actually becomes part of the orthogonal. We want this to be an orthogonal complex structure. Okay, and then the other extreme example is when we take a differential form, so it's a two-form omega, that's in wedge two of the cotangent bundle. We can view it as a map from T to T star just by taking interior product. And so here we get this off-diagonal matrix, omega minus omega inverse. So algebraically, we see that both these things are orthogonal transformations going to minus one. But then if we look at this condition, it it actually specializes to the integrability of the complex structure and the closure of bulk fit. So it actually interpolates between the two integrability conditions. Okay, so there's several kind of things to say about generalized complex structures, but the one that I want to bring to your attention today is that if we take the matrix of a general structure of this kind, it's not going to look like a diagonal or an anti-diagonal matrix. It'll look like this, a block form. And what I'm doing is singling out the top right-hand piece, which is a bivector, and the integrability condition that j bracket j zero implies in a very easy way that pi is Poisson, because inside this Courant bracket is the Lie bracket sitting in there. So the Lie structure is present to cause this to be a Poisson structure. And since we have a Poisson structure lying around, we can look at the rank of this Poisson tensor. And what that means is that for every point of a manifold which has a generalized complex structure, that thing has a rank, and so there's a pointwise invariant here. I've called it a local invariant. So there's a number at every point of a generalized complex structure, a generalized complex manifold, and that's the type. And that type doesn't have to be constant on the whole manifold. It could change along the loci. But for a 2n real dimensional manifold, the types can be anything from 0 all the way to n. And in the case 0, well, obviously here we can see that in the case of a symplectic structure, pi has full rank, and so here we get k equals 0. So that's the symplectic case. And in the case of the complex structure, the Poisson tensor is itself 0. So we get full type. Now, it may appear that here what we have are n plus 1 completely topologically distinct structures. It's given by an integer. But actually, those of the same parity are connected. So it's possible to deform, for example, from type n to type n minus 2, type n minus 4, etc. And depending on what dimension you're in, you may be able to deform from n all the way down to 0, thereby connecting the two moduli spaces, complex and symplectic structures, together. But that's not always possible. Sometimes in dimension 4k plus 2, in dimension 4k plus 2, n and 0 are not of the same parity, and so they're not connected. Okay, so, I mean, here I've just explained very briefly what is a generalized complex structure. So we have examples as a complex structure or a symplectic structure, but there are things in between, and those are described, in a sense, by the rank of this Poisson tensor. No, it's not close. The relationship between the other two tensors is more complicated, but it's interesting from the point of view of Poisson geometry. Actually, Marius Kreinick is investigating what kind of Poisson structure this is. Okay, so so let's say we want to understand not a generalization of complex or symplectic geometry, but let's go one step further, and let's try to generalize Kähler geometry. So let's remember, what is a Kähler manifold? A Kähler manifold is a smooth manifold with a triple of structures, a Riemannian metric, a complex structure, and a symplectic form, which commute in this way. Again, we're viewing two-form structures as maps from T to T star, just by interior product. Okay. Oops, I'm not used to this. It's very sensitive. Okay, so here we have this triple. But you could also look at it from the point of view of just two of the three structures. So suppose we take the complex structure and the symplectic structure. What does it mean for them to form a Kähler geometry? Well, first we have this condition, which simply means that their composition is a metric, and then we want that metric to be positive definite. Okay. So since we can, so what that means is we can express Kähler geometry in terms of generalized complex structures, J and omega, of this kind. And the observation is that this condition, the condition for them to form a Kähler pair, can be expressed as the fact that the two generalized complex structures commute. You see, I've just shown that they commute here. And then this positivity condition simply means that the product is a positive definite structure on T plus T star. So what that means is we can generalization of Kähler geometry, we could say, what is a generalized Kähler structure? It's a pair, JA and JB, of generalized complex structures, such that, first of all, they commute, and second of all, their product is positive definite. So this contains the Kähler geometry as a special case. And I've written down here what the structure reduction is. Reduction, you start off, if you just consider JA, it'll have a structure UN, N, but we know kind of topologically you can always restrict this to UN cross UN. But whether this is an integrable reduction depends on whether you can find another integrable generalized complex structure pair in JA. So again, I just want to draw your attention to a few properties of generalized Kähler geometry. So remember that each of the generalized complex structures have a type, this integer from 0 to n. And the fact that they need to commute and they need to be positive definite puts a constraint on the sum of the types, that they have to be less than or equal to n and congruent to n mod 2. So for example, on a four real dimensional manifold, n is equal to 2. And so the types can vary from 0, 1, and 2. So we're going to just write that. So in four dimensions, so in four, we have types 0, 1, and 2. This one is complex. This one is symplectic. And this one is something in between. What I'm saying is that in order to form a Kähler pair, you could, at every point of the manifold, you could join zero with a two. That's the usual Kähler structure. You could join a one with a one, which still satisfies those conditions. And you could also join a zero with a zero, because those conditions are satisfied. And all these situations do occur for Kähler. And then the other thing that I want to draw your attention to is this, that remember that so this is T and T star. I draw them this way because they're both null. Then if you take the product of JA and JB, then because of each one of them squares to minus 1, their product squares the identity G squared equals 1. So we have C plus minus, which are plus and minus 1 eigenspaces. And I'll just draw from here like this, C plus, C minus. So C plus is positive definite in the natural metric on T plus T star, and C minus is negative definite. So, but since these are definite subspaces and T and T star are both null, what that means is that we can, the projection onto the tangent bundle is an isomorphism. It's the intersection of C plus, minus with T or T star is 0. So you can project any information that you have on C plus, you can project it down to T. And actually, on C plus, you have, first of all, a Riemannian metric, since C plus is positive definite. And not only that, we also have you have complex structures, because C plus is stable under J, A, and J, B. So J, A, and J, B induce complex structures on C plus. And you can also view C plus as a map from T to T star in this way, just by taking the point from T, mapping it here, and mapping it there. And this map will have a skew and a symmetric component. And the metric that I mentioned here, G, is the symmetric part of that map, and B is the skew part of that map. So essentially, out of this data, C plus, you can project down to T and get all this data, a metric, a two-form, and two complex structures, J plus and J minus. So this is kind of like a decomposition, some kind of, we're extracting classical geometry out of this generalized Kähler geometry. Okay, so then one result that I want to mention is that there's an algebraic equivalence between these structures. So if I give you a JA and a JB, which form a generalized Kähler pair, then algebraically it's equivalent to giving you J plus, J minus, a two form, and a metric. And this is explicitly how you actually package that information into the two generalized complex structures. So JA is given by choosing the top sign and JB the bottom sign. So here we see that we're using all the information. We're using the complex structures, the small small b, and we're using omega plus, which is actually the metric composed with j plus. So we're using the metric in this expression. But that's just an algebraic statement that these two types of data are the same. What you want to know is what kind of integrability condition on these structures is implied by the fact that these are generalized complex structures. They are integrable with respect to the Kronecker bracket. So what does that mean for these structures? Well, this result says that the integrability condition on this data is that, first of all, the complex structures have to be integrable. And second of all, although these omega plus and omega minus are not Taylor, they're not closed, they're almost closed in the sense that we take derivatives of them and they're equal to this d of b. Now, I put here a plus h. This h kind of came out of nowhere, but the idea of this h is that if you give me a closed 3 form, you can actually add it to this dv, and you can modify everything that I said before by this 3 form by making one small modification, which is that you just take whatever, so the formula that we have for the Kronecker bracket, you just add one term, which is the interior product of both vectors on this 3 form. And this modification, you're modifying the bracket, and that means that you're modifying the integrability condition of JA and JB, which means you're modifying the integrability condition of this data, and that's how it modifies. So the addition of this H is not a very difficult step to make, but it's important for generality. Okay, and another way of writing these conditions is that you can construct two torsion connections by taking the Levici beta of G and adding this 3-form piece and requiring that the complex structures are covariant constant with respect to these. These are called the Bismuth connections. So this condition is equivalent to this one. So, when I found these integrability conditions, I brought them to Nigel Kitchen, and I said, have you ever seen such a structure? And he said, actually, shockingly enough, I have. Martin Gorchak told me about it 25 years ago, and I ignored him. So, because we didn't have kind of a good understanding of what this challenge meant. And in fact, not only Nigel ignored it, but most physicists ignored this paper and continued working not with these strange geometries, but with Taylor geometries from the original paper in Zanini. But what they did in 1984 was that they proved that if you have a sigma model and you require that at least on the classical level you have n equals 2 comma 2 supersymmetry, then the general geometry of the target space is exactly this data here, this bi-Hermitian geometry. So you have two complex structures, Hermitian and G. And yes? H's are closed freeform. So I'm just taking H's inside the closed freeform. This is twisting by a jerk. It changes the integrability conditions. It doesn't change the algebra, the pointwise algebra. Okay, and then just recently, this is very suggestive. At the time that they wrote this paper, they didn't have the idea of topological twists. Whereas for a Taylor manifold, we know that we can do topological twists. We can look only at the complex or only at the symplectic structure. This suggests that since this data can be repackaged in terms of two generalized complex structures, you might think that these are the two topological twists in these generalized things. And that's exactly what Kapustin has shown paper earlier this year. Okay, so that's kind of what the structure of these generalized Taylor manifolds looks like. And I just want to be very clear about this fact that generalized Taylor is equivalent to this bi-Hermitian 2 comma 2 geometry. Okay, and in this case, for the generalized Taylor, we have two generalized complex structures. They commute in this large space d plus d squared. But then, if you come down and interpret it this way, you still have two complex structures on T, but they don't have to. this is kind of the reason why they're so hard to work with at this level, and why they, for certain purposes, are easier to work with at this level. So you might ask, well, what are some examples of generalized Kähler structures? Well, I mean, first of all, any Kähler monopoly is generalized Kähler, where the types of the two structures, as I explained before, are type n and type 0. So this 0 is the symplectic, and n is the complex. So we have two generalized complex structures of extremely type. If you have a hyperkähler manifold, you can construct one by using the theorem. So you just take J plus and J minus to be two of the hyperkähler complex structures, and B to be omega of the third complex structure, and take G to be the hyperkähler metric. And that is also a generalized Kähler structure, where the type is type 0, 0. Another example is any primary Hopf surface or any finite cover of it. These complex surfaces actually admit two types of generalized complex structures. One is odd type, 1, 1, and the other one is even type, where on most of the manifold it looks like 0, 0. So for a Hopf surface, it kind of looks like this. It's type 0, 0 almost everywhere. But then the anti-canonical divisor looks like two elliptic curves. And on this elliptic curve, you get type 2, 0, and on this elliptic curve, you get type 0, 2. So you have type jumping on these two subclines, but only for one of the complex structures. Okay. Another example is any even dimensional semi-simple leak. If you take, so we know that any even dimensional semi-simple leak group, or any even dimensional leak group, has left and right invariant complex structures. And if you take those things and construct out of it a generalized Kähler structure, then that will be integrable, but only when you twist by this Lie form, you take the Cartan Lie form. And if you want to know what the type is, well, the type can jump quite a lot depending on what kind of structure the group has. So you can do a lot of type jumping on the Cartan Lie form. And recently, he spoke about this 2 days ago with a quite amazing proof, in my opinion. He proved, Hitchin proved recently, that if you take a generalized Kähler manifold, any of these, for example, and you study the moduli space of instantons, then this moduli space actually inherits a generalized Kähler structure. And that's particularly interesting because the moduli space may obtain a twist, even though the space you started with needn't have a twist. The twist is not preserved under this. All right, so since we have this nice generalized Kähler geometry, we might ask, what else can we prove about it which is similar to the Kähler case? Is there a Hodge theory for this kind of thing? The natural place to look is to see, can you find some operators which will cause the differential forms to decompose some natural way? And so you have two natural operators. You have the generalized Kähler structures themselves, JA and JB. And these things are acting on T plus T star, but there's a spin representation. So we can map them into endomorphisms of the spinners. And because these things have plus and minus I eigenspaces on T plus T star, they'll also have, they'll have an eigenvalue decomposition on these spinners. And so these differential forms, when you complexify, can be decomposed into IR and IS eigenspaces for these two. And here, again, it's very important that these commute, because if you take the eigenspaces of JA, then because JB commutes with JA, then the eigenspaces of JA will decompose under the action of JB. So we're using the commutativity very strongly here to make this. The indices are a little bit different because of the way that it's indexed. It's not just any R index, but it forms a diamond, which I'll show you in a second. And this, I just wanted to make a remark that that this decomposition is actually orthogonal, but not with respect to the usual metric. You have to modify the notion of metric on differential forms, making use of the fact that you have this B as well as the G. You have the symmetric and the skew symmetric. And these combine together to give you a metric on differential forms, which looks almost exactly like what physicists call the Born-Infeld metric. You have this determinant, square root of a determinant of G plus B. okay, and what does this look like? It looks like this. You just get a Hodge diamond. Okay. Very similar to the case of Keller geometry. And then, since you have this kind of diamond structure, you can say, suppose we take a differential form in one of the spaces in the Hodge diamond. Then, suppose we act on it by the exterior derivative, what happens? Well, because of integrability, what happens is that the exterior derivative decomposes into four parts. Right? It's no longer the case that it just goes into two directions. It goes in all directions near it. So it goes into all these spaces. And all of these operators are differentials, u squared to u zero. And if you look at this Born-Infeld metric, and you take adjoints of these operators, then you can show that the adjoint of this operator is just this operator, and the adjoint of this operator is just this operator. An obvious thing to conjecture, and it turns out to be true, except there's a minus on it. And so we obtain kind of on these complex differential forms on a generalized Cayley manifold, we obtain all these four operators. And if you look at the commutation relations between these operators, then what you see is that they actually form a representation of this n equals 2 comma 2 algebra at the classical level. So the n equals 2 algebra has some other operators corresponding to momentum and boost, and those obviously vanish on this. These will vanish if you check on this representation. But this is interesting because, you know, although Gates, Hall, and Rochek knew that the target geometry had this supersymmetry, it was not manifest. They didn't know what the supersymmetric operators were on this geometry. So this is telling you in a very easy way what they are. They're just parts of the exterior derivative. Okay, so based on those Kähler identities, those identities that you just saw, you can prove that actually the cohomology of the manifold with complex coefficients does split. So this decomposition of differential forms actually goes to cohomology. Now here, what I've said is, I've made a slightly more general statement, which is if the twist is non-zero, if this H field is non-zero, then the thing that is decomposed is actually the twisted cohomology. The twisted cohomology is not set graded because twisted cohomology is just taking cohomology with respect to D plus H wedge. So this is degree three, this is degree one. So all it does is it goes from the even bonds to the odd bonds and back. So there's only really two cohomology groups for this derivative. But even though there's only two of these groups, it actually breaks up, as I said, cross Z. So it breaks up, as I said, cross Z, even in the twisted case, which was a surprise to me. I kind of thought for some reason that it should be only two. Okay, and so just as in the case of the Hodge decomposition, whenever you know that a manifold is Kähler, it has a Hodge decomposition, which means that you can put topological constraints on the manifold itself. And in this case, you can because of its decomposition as well. And so just a specific example is if you have a four-dimensional manifold which admits generalized Kähler structure, and if you know that this twist is zero, then there's a constraint. V1 has to be even and V2 plus has to be odd, and that's for any generalized Kähler structure. But if you specifically want one of type 1-1, then in addition you have the constraint that V2 must be even. So for example, if you took CP1, then because V2 is equal to 1, it doesn't admit a type 1-1 structure. So this is a problem. Okay, and the other thing I would like to warn you about is that this PQ decomposition is actually not exactly the usual Hodge decomposition in the Cayley case. It's some kind of a permutation of it, okay? And this permutation was actually known by Nicholson, and she called it the Clipper decomposition. And this is not an equality, but there's an isomorphism, there's a map which she found called the Hodge automorphism, which takes this space to the RS forms. So this is the isomorphism that brings you between the two decompositions. U is this one here, this PQ decomposition for generalized Kähler, and this is the usual PQ for a complex manifold. I just used these identities. These are generalizations of the Cato identities. So, yes, yeah, and also DH harmonic form, so twisted harmonic form. Okay. These are harmonic forms with respect to this other metric. All right, so kind of that's all I wanted to say about Hodge theory for generalized Kähler manifolds. So there is a Hodge theory, and kind of the next topic I wanted to discuss was T-duality. But if anyone has questions about either generalized complex or generalized Kähler, please. Anton? Okay. I'm sorry, yeah. So that's right. Just a correction that the paper where it's shown that topological twist corresponds to generalized Kähler structures was done by Twist and Kennedy. Okay, so yes. The exterior derivative is just the usual one, but for this Hodge decomposition, it's D plus H. It's this one, so it's order. It's just odd order. Well, because the thing is that if you look at one of these spaces, say UPQ, inside that space, there's mixed degree forms. They're not of a specific degree. That's maybe a bit confusing, but all we know is whether the forms are even or odd degree, not whether they have a specific degree. Because the specific degree is not an invariant under the spin n comma n. Only the odd or evenness of the spinner is a spin invariant. Okay. So the next thing I want to discuss is t-duality. Which is a kind of project to understand what physicists mean by t-duality from a geometric point of view. And our approach, this is joint work with Gilles Cavalcanti, who's almost finished his thesis in Oxford. And what we are doing is really following in the footsteps of Fulknecht, Epsilon, and Mathai, who have had a very nice paper about t-duality, explaining it in a very nice topological and geometrical way. And what we're looking at is doing t-duality along circle actions or torus actions, where the geometries we're trying to t-dualize are invariant. They really are just invariant. But we're allowing non-trivial topology for the bundles, and we're also allowing flux, this H flux. I should mention that there are some earlier ideas from 98 and 99 of Veneziano, where you know he was looking at this whole problem from the t-duality point of view at the beginning. Since SONN or spin NN is the t-duality group, he kind of saw that you should think of spinners for that group, and so this idea of thinking of differential forms as spinners, he called them phi spinners, is really something that he was working on as well. And then I should also say that if you want to know how to generalize this assumption of invariance, if you don't want it to be invariance, there's some recent work of Florin Benbassad, who's here at this conference, where he studies t-duality in the situation where the geometries are not exactly invariant, but there's what he calls semi-flat. Okay, so what is the setup that I'm talking about today? So let's just talk about t-duality between the principal S1 bundles. So what is the data that we begin with? So suppose you start off with a principal S1 bundle, P, and you choose a connection on it, which is just a one form on P, which has curvature F. And then you also have a flux, so you have a three form on this principal bundle with integral charge. And let's assume that this three form, we have it as a differential form, not just the cohomology class, we have the differential form. And it's S1 invariant. So that means that we can take the freeform and write it in terms of the connection wedge and two-form coming from the base plus a three-form coming from the base. So this is just, since we only have one fiber-wise direction, we're just decomposing it in terms of fiber and base. Then what can we do? Well, if we have this principal bundle, we can integrate this three-form over the fibers, and we get a two-form in the base. And this two-form is integral. And because it's integral, we can consider it to be the first turn class of a new principal bundle, P3. So in this way, out of H and P, we just construct a new principal S1 bundle, different topology. Okay? All right. And then what we can do is choose any connection on this principal bundle, this new one, and then define a new free form by taking U wedge this F, which is the curvature of the first connection, plus H, which is the same H as the one that we had in this data. So this, from the physicist's point of view, this would be constructing the construction of the T-dual. I prefer to think of it as a relationship between two principal S1 bundles with flux. But actually, if you, so here I say that you choose a connection, but if we kind of became a little bit more fancy and thought of this H field not as just a freeform, but as the curvature of a gerb, then because the curvature of a gerb has extra data, it actually induces a unique connection on P12. So it tells us which one to pick. This is just like saying that a connection on a gerb is the same as a line bundle with connection on the loop space, because the base B can be thought of as lying naturally in the loop space. It corresponds to a bunch of circles. But anyway, it's a very simple construction. Principal circle bundle with three flux gives you another principal bundle. So here we have a principal bundle with its three flux, fibering over the base B and the same and the same base as the base for another principal bundle with its each flux. And here I've just predicted the fiber product of the two flux. So this is a kind of T-duality is at the topological level is a way of exchanging flux with topology. So you start off with an S1 bundle with topology, but without any H flux. You integrate it over the fibers, which gives you zero, and then you construct a new S1 bundle, which is trivial. But now it has an H flux, which is just the volumes of the two. Well, so I said that the connection is induced by this choice of gauge of the gerb connection structure. But instead, you can just think of it this way. You choose a connection. And then that choice of connection determines what the three form is. You just choose a connection on the principal one. Yeah, suppose you choose it arbitrary. The data equate only when you use a true gerb connection, because it has, the gerb connection doesn't have only the curvature, it also has the connection itself. And there is, but only at the level of gerbs. I just didn't want to go into that. So the theorem in Bouchnek, Epsilon, and Mappai's paper is that if you have two principal bundles connected in this way, so they have this relationship between each other, then the H-twisted K theory of P is isomorphic to the H-tilde-twisted K theory of P-twisted. And then they prove this implies the same twisted topology. So that's kind of a topological statement. What we were interested in was to see what does it mean geometrically for these two things to be T-dual. So what it means is that by taking pullback by F, this is similar to the Fourier Hilbert transform. You pull back by F, you multiply by E to this two form U wedge U twiddle, and then you push forward by G. This is a transformation which you can use to transform many different objects. So in particular, Alan Weinstein knew for a while that if you have a Dirac structure, if you have something sitting inside T plus T star, let's say this is positive definite, but there could be something D which is null. Just like T and T star, it could be another null one. And if you have a map between manifolds, then such things, you can push them forward and pull them back. This is an advantage to using the tangent and the cotangent. When you're using a T and T star, you can push and you can pull. And you use that to your advantage to be able to push and pull these subspaces for any map between manifolds. And actually, an important observation to make for my purposes is that you can do it even with positive definite subspaces or null or any kind of subspace which is defined in terms of the natural structure on people's T-star that can be pulled back and pushed forward under these maps. And this induces so since P and P2 are manifolds, you can consider the Coulomb bracket on T plus T star twisted by H. Okay, and if we mod out by S1 to get bundles over B, these will both be so-called Courant algebras because they'll be bundles for the bracket structure. Okay. And it turned out that this map F induces an isomorphism of the Courant algebra structure from this twisted bracket to that twisted bracket. So that means that any kind of structure which is defined in terms of the Courant structure can be transformed naturally from one side to the other. So this slide is about transport of geometric structure. So I'm just saying here that I can actually transport any one of these generalized geometries over to the other side. So for example, suppose you take a generalized metric on P. This generalized metric is exactly this C plus. You know, once I know what this G, once I know the plus one eigenspace C plus, this is telling me what the metric is. And if I pull back, apply this e to the f, and push forward, then I'm going to get another positive definite subspace in p-twiddle. And it's going to be given by a metric in two form, but different ones. So this very simple formula, if you expand it all out, then you get a bunch of formulas relating this g-twiddle to the previous g and the previous b, and this b-twiddle in terms of both the g and the b before. And these rules are called the Buescher rules. They were discovered by Buescher. And physicists use these rules all the time to do T-duality. But it's important to understand that not only... Sorry. Question? Okay. It's important to realize that the metric is not the only thing you can have rules for. You can transform any Dirac structure this way using these operations defined by one. And you can transport any generalized complex structure to the other side, too. So, suppose that you have B mapping W, right? And you have a subspace sitting inside V plus V star. Okay. Now I want to push it forward to W. So I'm finding that this is inside W plus W star. So what you do, F star L is equal to what? It's equal to the set of F of V plus psi inside W plus W star. Such that V plus F pullback of psi is inside L. So you use the, I should maybe put, I mean, derivative. So you use the derivative of F and the pullback on forms on each side. And this, this could be a Dirac form. Plus, it's positive definite spaces too. Now, the important thing to realize is that when you actually do this transformation on a generalized complex structure, the type that you get on the other side changes. It certainly changes parity. It can change the actual value by plus or minus one. Okay? So, for example, if you're in six dimensions, and if you start with a complex structure, which is type three, then with one T-duality, you go down to type 2, another to type 1, and then 3, you go down to 0. So So this is a kind of very naive reasoning for explaining why, you know, if you want to do mirror symmetry between complex and symplectic, you need to do three T duodenums along the three torus. Kind of just algebraically, it explains what is happening in between with this mirror symmetry. And I mean, this looks especially in this situation that we have with torsion with this curve. It would be important to compare this work with the work of DiMaggio and Pantin, who in the algebraic case understand very well how to do T-duality when you have a curve. So let's see what happens when we transport a generalized Kähler structure. If we started with a generalized Kähler structure, JA and JB, we can certainly do T-duality to get some other ones. Now, because the, and so we have a decomposition into the cohomology of this generalized Kähler manifold into the RS pieces, this Clifford decomposition. That's why I put H lower C here. This Clifford decomposition is defined totally in terms of the structures on T plus T sub. And because this T-duality transformation is an isomorphism of T plus T sub on this side to T plus T sub on the other side, it doesn't change this decomposition. So the decomposition of the cohomology is sent to itself. It doesn't change the RS types. But the important thing to realize is that if this was actually a Kähler structure, then if you had a complex structure and a symplectic structure, and you did, let's say, in the six-dimensional case, three T-dualities, and you went over to the other side, then although it's true that the Clifford decomposition of this structure corresponds to the usual Kähler decomposition, the ordering of J and omega is important in making that identification. So the RS cohomology and the PQ cohomology is actually isomorphic, but the way that you do the isomorphism depends on the ordering of the JA and the JB. So because under T-duality you've changed the order of what is symplectic and what is complex, this identification becomes switched. Okay. So although the Clifford cohomology stays the same under mirror symmetry or T-duality, it's this kind of non-invariantly defined Durham cohomology, if you want, which actually has to switch, which has to change to. Now I put this in blue because this is a very naive statement. I mean, we don't have any examples of Kähler except for the torus manifolds, which actually have torus symmetry that you can T-dualize and get a compact manifold of the other side. But just from a naive point of view, it explains kind of algebraically what is going on when you're doing these T-dualities. Yeah, and actually, from this point of view, when we look at principal S1 bundles, it may not be so difficult to imagine what happens. Well, okay, I mean, we've studied the case when we increase this S1 to a torus, but then if we change it to S2 or to other groups, obviously we can't carry it out exactly what we've done. But it may be possible to make some modifications. In the string theory literature, there is some work on T-duality for non-abelian groups. I found an old paper in Zenia Velasa about this subject. I hope to think more about it further. But I think that I'll leave it at that and ask if there's any questions. Yeah. You have two. You should speak with the microphone.
Yeah, two B fields. NS B field and more B field.
Right.
So we'll have to generalize another two B field because this is
complicated. Yeah, by S duality. Yeah. Oh, that's an interesting comment. So, I mean, it's. There's a. So everything that I've, today I was very careful to speak in terms of these structures on T plus T star, but if you look at this decomposition. So you have this new PQ becomes a QRS decomposition. And you have this diamond. So you have U minus M0 and U 0 minus M. Okay. Like this. Okay. Then the extremities here, the corners, just as in the case of a Kähler manifold, these are line bundles. And these are the canonical bundles of the two generalized complex functions. So this is the canonical bundle, canonical line bundle of JA, and this is the canonical bundle of JB. And in the special case, so you can ask, you know, is it possible to find a trivialization of this line bundle which is closed? So can you find a differential form inside this line bundle such that d rho is equal to 0 and rho is already equal to 0. Okay. So that's the analog of asking a Kähler manifold to be Calabi-Yau. You have a section of the canonical bundle which is closed. Okay. So if you take this differential form, then these are kind of like, these differential forms can be decomposed into rho. Well, I'll just give an example. It looks something like e to a function, e to two form, this two form that I mentioned, as something else. And so these look kind of like the dilaton and the B field. And then these look like Ramona-Ramona fields. And so they could be, for example, zero to two. So actually sitting, what I'm trying to say is that if you interpret these generalized complex structures in terms of forms, which you can do, then you can see more differential forms than the ones I said. You can see that there are other Ramon-Ramon fields which are sitting there. And actually studying S-duality is definitely, hoping to learn more about S-duality at this conference. Do you really think I have the answer to that? No, I don't. But I do have a comment to make about it, which is that so there is a notion of a generalized complex submanifold. Okay. If you look at, so there are things called generalized complex submanifolds. And in the complex case, and these are just complex submanifolds with holomorphic line bundles. And in the symplectic case, the interesting thing is that you get Ramjians with flat bundles, but there's also these coisotropic A-brands discovered by Gustav Kolomb. So you get these coisotropic A-brands. And in the general case, you get other things. You still have this definition of a generalized complex submanifold. So, you know, what do we know about these special submanifolds? Well, I know that any of these generalized complex submanifolds has a canonically defined elliptic complex on it. You can take cohomology of it, and it gives you a finite dimensional cohomology space. So that at least tells you what the endomorphisms of these objects are themselves, say. Okay, now, in order to know what it would mean to take a morphism between two of these objects, that's beyond what I understand. But if you want to know more, you should ask Eric Zaslow and his student Marco Alvi, because they've been studying this question.
Any other questions?
With Fernando Cavello. Okay. Sorry about that.
Any questions, comments? Let's